Side 2, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 48.
"What's the plan?" Carlton asked.
"The innkeeper thinks there's a monastery near a village about 5 leagues away. We should reach it by morning. I want to get word of all this to Dolmant in Kyrelos."
"I could take the message to him for you, Sir Sparhawk,"
Beirut offered eagerly.
Sparhawk shook his head.
"The Seeker probably has your scent by now, Beirut. I don't want you getting ambushed on the road to Kyrelos. Let's send some anonymous monk instead. That monastery's on our way anyhow, so we won't be losing any time. Let's mount up."
The moon was full and the night sky was clear as they rode away from the inn.
"That way," Curic said, pointing.
"How do you know that?"
Talon asked him.
"The stars," Curic replied.
"Do you mean you can actually tell direction by the stars?"
Talon sounded impressed.
"Of course you can. Sailors have been doing that for thousands of years."
"I didn't know that."
"You should have stayed in school."
"I don't plan to be a sailor, Curic. Stealing fish sounds a little too much like work to me."
They rode on through the moon-drenched night, moving almost due east. By morning they had come perhaps 5 leagues, and Sparhawk rode to a hilltop to look around.
"There's a village just ahead," he told the others when he returned. "Let's hope it's the one we're looking for."
The village lay in a shallow valley. It was a small place, perhaps a dozen stone houses, with a church at one end of its single cobbled street, and a tavern at the other. A large walled building stood atop a hill just outside of town.
"Excuse me, neighbor," Sparhawk asked the passerby as they clattered into town. "Is this Veyrani?"
"It is."
"And is that the monastery up on that hill there?"
"It is,"
the man replied again, his voice a bit sullen.
"Is there some problem?"
"The monks up there own all the land hereabouts," the fellow replied. "Their rents are cruel."
"Isn't that always the way? All landlords are greedy."
"The monks insist on tithes as well as the rent. That's going a bit far, wouldn't you say?"
"You've got a point there."
"Why do you call everybody neighbor?" Tinian asked as they rode on.
"Habit, I suppose," Sparhawk shrugged. "I got it from my father, and it sort of puts people at their ease."
"Why not call them friend?"
"Because I never know that for sure. Let's go talk to the abbot of that monastery."
The monastery was a severe-looking building surrounded by a wall made of yellow sandstone. The fields around it were well tended, and monks wearing conical hats woven from local straw worked patiently under the morning sun in long, straight rows of vegetables. The gates of the monastery stood open, and Sparhawk and the others rode into the central courtyard. A thin, haggard-looking brother came out to meet them, his face a bit fearful-looking.
"Good day, brother," Sparhawk said to him.
He opened his cloak to reveal the heavy silver amulet hanging on a chain about his neck that identified him as a Pandion knight.
"If it's not too much trouble, we'd like to have a word with your abbot."
"I'll bring him immediately, my lord."
The brothers scurried back inside the building. The abbot was a jolly little fat man with a well-shaved tonsure and a bright red, sweaty face. His was a small, remote monastery and had little contact with Kyrelos. He was almost embarrassingly obsequious at the sudden, unexpected appearance of church knights on his doorstep.
"My lords," he almost groveled, "how may I serve you?"
"It's a small thing, my lord abbot," Sparhawk told him gently. "Are you acquainted with the Patriarch of Deimos?"
The abbot swallowed hard.
"Patriarch Dolmant?" he said in an awed voice.
"Tall fellow," Sparhawk agreed. "Sort of lean and underfed looking. Anyway, we need to get a message to him. Have you a young monk who's got some stamina and a good horse who could carry a message to the Patriarch for us? It's in the service of the church."
"Of course, Sir Knight."
"I'd hoped you'd feel that way about it. Do you have a quill pen and ink handy, my lord abbot? I'll compose the message, and then we won't bother you any more."
"One other thing, my lord abbot," Carlton added. "Might we trouble you for a bit of food? We've been some time on the road, and our supplies are getting low.
Nothing too exotic, mind. A few roast chickens, perhaps. Maybe a ham or two. A side of bacon. A hindquarter of beef, maybe.
Of course, Sir Knight, the abbot agreed quickly.
Sparhawk composed the note to Dolmant while Curic and Calton loaded the supplies on a packhorse.
Did you have to do that? Sparhawk asked Calton as they rode away.
Charity is a cardinal virtue, Sparhawk, Calton replied loftily. I like to encourage it whenever I can. The countryside through which they galloped grew increasingly desolate. The soil was thin and poor, fit only for thorn bushes and weeds. Here and there were pools of stagnant water, and the few trees standing near them were stunted and sick-looking. The weather had turned cloudy, and they rode through the tag end of a dreary afternoon. Curic pulled his gelding in beside Sparhawk.
Doesn't look too promising, does it? He noted.
Dismal,
Sparhawk agreed.
I think we're going to have to make camp somewhere tonight. The horses are almost played out.
I'm not feeling too spry myself, Sparhawk admitted. His eyes felt gritty, and he had a dull headache.
The only trouble is that I haven't seen any clean water for the last league or so. Why don't I take Bayrit and see if we can find a spring or stream?
Keep your eyes open, Sparhawk cautioned. Curic turned in his saddle.
Bayrit, he called. I need you.
Sparhawk and the others rode on at a trot while the squire and the novice ranged out in search of clean water.
We could just ride on, you know, Calton said.
Not unless you feel like walking before morning, Sparhawk replied.
Curic's right. The horses don't have very much left in them.
That's true, I suppose. Then Curic and Bayrit came pounding down a nearby hill at a gallop.
Get ready, Curic shouted, shaking loose his chain mace. We've got company.
Sephrania, Sparhawk barked. Take flute and get back behind those rocks. Talon, get the pack horses.
He drew his sword and moved to the front even as the others armed themselves. There were 15 or so of them, and they drove their horses over the hilltop at a run. It was an oddly assorted group, church soldiers in their red tunics, styrics in homespun smocks, and a few peasants. Their faces were all blank, and their eyes dull. They charged on mindlessly, even though the heavily armed church knights were rushing to meet them. Sparhawk and the others spread out, preparing to meet the charge.
For God and the church! Bavier shouted, brandishing his Lochaber axe.
Then he spurred his horse forward, crashing into the middle of the oncoming attackers. Sparhawk was taken off guard by the young Cyrenic's rash move, but he quickly recovered and charged in to his companion's aid. Bavier, however, appeared to need little in the way of help. He warded off the clumsy-appearing sword strokes of the mindlessly charging ambushers with his shield, and his long-handled Lochaber whistled through the air to sink deep into the bodies of his enemies. Though the wounds he inflicted were hideous, the men he struck down made no outcry as they fell from their saddles. They fought and died in an eerie silence. Sparhawk rode behind Bavier, cutting down any of the numb-faced men who tried to attack the Cyrenic from behind. His sword sheared a church soldier almost in half, but the man in the red tunic did not even flinch. He raised his sword to strike at Bavier's back, but Sparhawk split his head open with a vast overhand stroke. The soldier toppled out of his saddle and lay twitching on the blood-stained grass. Calton and Tinian had flanked the attackers on either side and were chopping their way into the melee, while Ulith, Curic, and Bayrit intercepted the few survivors who managed to make their way through the concerted counterattack. The ground was soon littered with bodies in red tunics and bloody white styric smocks. Riderless horses plunged away from the fight, squealing in panic. In normal circumstances, Sparhawk knew the attackers bringing up the rear would falter and then flee when they saw what had befallen their comrades. These expressionless men, however, continued their attack, and it was necessary to kill them to the last man.
Sparhawk! Sephrania shouted. Up there!
She was pointing toward the hilltop over which the attack had come. It was the tall, skeletal figure in the black hooded robe that Sparhawk had seen twice before. It sat its horse atop the hill with that faint green glow emanating from its concealed face.
That thing's starting to bore me, Calton said. The best way to get rid of a bug is to step on it.
He raised his shield and thumped his heels to his horse's flanks.
He started to gallop up the hill, his blade held menacingly aloft.
"Colton, no!"
Sophronia's shout was shrill with fright, but Colton paid no attention to her warning. Sparhawk swore and started after his friend. But then, Colton was suddenly hurled from his saddle by some unseen force, as the figure atop the hill gestured almost contemptuously. With revulsion, Sparhawk saw that what emerged from the sleeve of the black robe was not a hand, but more closely resembled the front claw of a scorpion. And then, even as he swung down from Farron's back to run to Colton's aid, Sparhawk gaped in astonishment. Somehow, Flute had escaped from Sophrania's watchful eye and had advanced to the foot of the hill. She stamped one grass-stained little foot imperiously and lifted her rude pipes to her lips. Her melody was stern, even slightly discordant. For some peculiar reason, it seemed to be accompanied by a vast, unseen choir of human voices. The hooded figure on the hilltop reeled back in its saddle, as if it had been struck a massive blow. Flute's song rose, and that unseen choir swelled its song in a mighty crescendo. The sound was so overpowering that Sparhawk was forced to cover his ears. The song had reached the level of physical pain. The figure shrieked a dreadfully inhuman sound, and it also clapped its claws to the sides of its hooded head. Then it wheeled its horse and fled down the far side of the hill. There was no time to pursue the monstrosity. Colton lay gasping on the ground, his face pale and his hands clutching at his stomach. "Are you all right?" Sparhawk demanded, kneeling beside his friend.
"Leave me alone," Colton wheezed.
"Don't be stupid. Are you hurt?"
"No, I'm lying here for fun."
The blond man drew in a shuddering breath.
"What did it hit me with? I've never been hit that hard before."
"You'd better let me have a look at you."
"I'm all right, Sparhawk. It just knocked the breath out of me, that's all."
"You idiot. You know what that thing is. What were you thinking of?" Sparhawk was suddenly irrationally angry.
"It seemed like a good idea at the time."
Colton grinned weakly.
"Maybe I should have thought my way through it a little more."
"Is he hurt?" Xavier asked, dismounting and coming toward them, his face showing his concern.
"I think he'll be all right."
Then Sparhawk rose, controlling his temper with some effort.
"Sir Xavier," he said rather formally, "you've had training in this sort of thing. You know what you're supposed to do when you're under attack. What possessed you to dash into the middle of them like that?"
"I didn't think there were all that many of them, Sparhawk," Xavier replied defensively.
"There were enough. It only takes one to kill you."
"You're vexed with me, aren't you, Sparhawk?" Xavier's voice was mournful. Sparhawk looked at the young knight's earnest face for a moment. Then he sighed.
"No, Xavier, I guess not. You just startled me, that's all. Please, for the sake of my nerves, don't do unexpected things anymore. I'm not getting any younger, and surprises age me."
"Perhaps I didn't consider the feelings of my comrades," Xavier admitted contritely. "I promise it will not happen again."
"I appreciate that, Xavier.
Let's help Colton back down the hill. I want Sophrania to take a look at him, and I'm sure she'll want to have a talk with him. A nice, long one." Colton winced.
"I don't suppose I could talk you into leaving me here. This is nice, soft dirt."
"Not a chance, Colton," Sparhawk replied ruthlessly.
"Don't worry, though. She likes you, so she probably won't do anything to you. Nothing permanent, anyway."
Chapter 3 Sophrania was tending a large, ugly-looking bruise on Bayrit's upper arm when Sparhawk and Xavier helped the weakly protesting Colton down the hill to her.
"Is it bad?" Sparhawk asked the young novice.
"It's nothing, my lord," Bayrit said bravely, although his face was pale.
"Is that the very first thing they teach you, Pandions?" Sophrania asked acidly. "To make light of your injuries. Bayrit's mail shirt stopped most of the blow, but in about an hour his arm's going to be purple from elbow to shoulder. He'll barely be able to use it."
"You're in a cheerful humor this morning, little mother," Colton said to her.
She pointed a threatening finger at him. "Calton," she said, "sit. I'll deal with you after I've tended Barrett's arm." Calton sighed and slumped down onto the ground. Sparhawk looked around. "Where are Euleth, Tinian, and Keurig?" he asked. "They're scouting around to make sure there aren't any more ambushes laid for us, Sir Sparhawk," Barrett replied. "Good idea." "That creature didn't look so very dangerous to me," Xavier said. "A little mysterious, perhaps, but not all that dangerous." "It didn't hit you," Calton told him. "It's dangerous, all right. Take my word for it."
"It's more dangerous than you could possibly imagine," Sophronia said. "It can send whole armies after us."
"If it's got the kind of power that knocked me off my horse, it doesn't need armies."
"You keep forgetting, Calton. Its mind is the mind of Azash. The gods prefer to have humans do their work for them."
"The men who came down that hill were like sleepwalkers," Xavier said, shuddering. "We cut them to pieces, and they didn't make a sound."
He paused, frowning.
"I didn't think Styrix were so aggressive," he added. "I've never seen one with a sword in his hand before."
"Those weren't Western Styrix," Sophronia said, tying off the padded bandage around Barrett's upper arm. "Try not to use that too much," she instructed. "Give it time to heal."
"Yes, ma'am," Barrett replied. "Now that you mention it, though, it is getting a little sore."
She smiled and put an affectionate hand on his shoulder. "This one may be all right, Sparhawk. His head isn't quite solid bone, like some I could name." She glanced meaningfully at Calton.
"Sophronia,"
the blonde knight protested. "Get out of the mail shirt," she told him crisply. "I want to see if you've broken anything."
"You said the Styrix in that group weren't Western Styrix," Xavier said to her.
"No, they were Zamox. It's more or less what we guessed back at that inn. The Seeker will use anybody, but a Western Styrix is incapable of using weapons made of steel. If they'd been local people, their swords would have been bronze or copper."
She looked critically at Calton, who had just removed his mail shirt. She shuddered.
"You look like a blonde rug," she told him.
"It's not my fault, little mother," he said, suddenly blushing. "All the men in my family have been hairy."
Xavier looked puzzled.
"What finally drove that creature off?" he asked.
"Flute," Sparhawk replied. "She's done it before. She even ran off the Darmok once with her pipes."
"This tiny child?"
Xavier's tone was incredulous.
"There's more to Flute than meets the eye," Sparhawk told him. He looked out across the slope of the hill. "Talon," he shouted. "Stop that."
Talon, who had been busy pillaging the dead, looked up with some consternation.
"But Sparhawk," he began. "Just come away from there. That's disgusting."
"But
do as he says," Barrett roared.
Talon sighed and came back down the hill.
"Let's go round up the horses, Xavier," Sparhawk said. "As soon as Keurig and the others get back, I think we'll want to move on. That Seeker is still out there, and it can come at us with a whole new group of people at any time."
"It can do that at night as well as in the daylight, Sparhawk," Xavier said dubiously.
"And it can follow our scent."
"I know. At this point, I think speed is our only defense. We're going to have to try to outrun that thing again."
Keurig, Euleth, and Tinian returned as dust was settling over the desolate landscape.
"There doesn't seem to be anybody else out there," the squire reported, swinging down from his gelding.
"We're going to have to keep going," Sparhawk told him.
"The horses are right on the verge of exhaustion, Sparhawk," the squire protested.
He looked at the others.
"And the people aren't in much better shape. None of us has had very much sleep in the past 2 days."
"I'll take care of it," Sophronia said calmly, looking up from her examination of Calton's hairy torso.
"How?"
Calton sounded just a bit grumpy. She smiled at him and wiggled her fingers under his nose.
"How else?"
"If there's a spell that counteracts the way we're all feeling right now, why didn't you teach it to us before?"
Sparhawk was also feeling somewhat surly since his headache had returned. "Because it's dangerous, Sparhawk," she replied. "I know you, Pandions. Given certain circumstances, you'd try to go on for weeks."
"So? If the spell really works, what difference does it make?"
"The spell only makes you feel as if you've rested. But you have not, in fact. If you push it too far, you'll die."
Oh. That stands to reason, I guess. I'm glad you understand.
How's Bayrett? Tinian asked.
He'll be sore for a while, but he's all right, she replied.
The young fellow shows some promise, Euleth said. When his arm heals, I'll give him some instruction with that axe of his. He's got the right spirit, but his technique's a little shaky.
Bring the horses over here, Sophrenia told them. She began to speak in Styric, uttering some of the words under her breath and concealing her moving fingers from them.
Try though he might, Sparhawk could not catch all of the incantation, nor even guess at the gestures that enhanced the spell.
Then he suddenly felt enormously refreshed. The dull headache was gone, and his mind was clear. One of the pack horses, whose head had been drooping and whose legs had been trembling violently, actually began to prance around like a colt.
Good spell, Euleth said laconically. Shall we get started?
They helped Bayrett into his saddle and rode out in the luminous twilight. The full moon rose an hour or so later, and it gave them sufficient light to risk a canter.
There's a road just over that hill up ahead, Curic told Sparhawk. We saw it when we were looking around. It goes more or less in the right direction, and we could make better time if we follow it instead of stumbling over broken ground in the dark.
I expect you're right, Sparhawk agreed, and we want to get out of this area as quickly as possible.
When they reached the road, they pushed on to the east at a gallop. It was well past midnight when clouds moved in from the west, obscuring the night sky. Sparhawk muttered an oath and slowed their pace. Just before dawn, they came to a river, and the road turned north. They followed it, searching for a bridge or a ford. The dawn was gloomy under the heavy cloud cover. They rode upriver a few more miles, and then the road bent east again and ran down into the river to emerge on the far side. Beside the ford stood a small hut. The man who owned the hut was a sharp-eyed fellow in a green tunic who demanded a toll to cross. Rather than argue with him, Sparhawk paid what he asked.
Tell me, neighbor, he said when the transaction was completed, how far is the Pelosian border?
About 5 leagues, the sharp-eyed fellow replied. If you move along, you should reach it by afternoon.
Thanks, neighbor. You've been most helpful.
They splashed on across the ford. When they reached the other side, Talon rode up beside Sparhawk.
Here's your money back, the young thief said, handing over several coins.
Sparhawk gave him a startled look.
I don't object to paying a toll to cross a bridge, Talon sniffed. After all, somebody had to go to the expense of building it. That fellow was just taking advantage of a natural shallow place in the river, though. It didn't cost him anything, so why should he make a profit from it?
You cut his purse, then?
Naturally.
And there was more in it than just my coins.
A bit. Let's call it my fee for recovering your money. After all, I deserve a profit too, don't I?
You're incorrigible.
I needed the practice.
From the other side of the river there came a howl of anguish.
I'd say he just discovered his loss, Sparhawk observed.
It does sort of sound that way, doesn't it?
The soil on the far side of the river was not a great deal better than the scrubby wasteland through which they had just passed. Occasionally they saw poor farmsteads where shabby-looking peasants in muddy brown smocks labored long and hard to wrest scanty crops from the unyielding earth. Curic sniffed disdainfully.
Amateurs, he grunted.
Curic took farming very seriously. About mid-morning, the narrow track they were following joined a well-traveled road that ran due east.
A suggestion, Sparhawk, Finian said, shifting his blue-blazoned shield.
Suggest away.
It might be better if we took this road to the border rather than cutting across country again. Pelosians tend to be sensitive about people who avoid the manned border crossings. They're obsessively concerned about smugglers. I don't think we'd accomplish very much in a skirmish with one of their patrols.
All right, Sparhawk agreed. Let's stay out of trouble if we can.
Not very long after a dreary, sunless noon, they reached the border and passed without incident into the southern end of Pelosia. The farmsteads here were even more run down than they had been in northeastern Elania. The houses and outbuildings were universally roofed with sod, and agile goats grazed on the roofs.
Curick looked about disapprovingly, but said nothing. As evening settled over the landscape, they crested a hill and saw the twinkling lights of a village in the valley below.
"An inn, perhaps?" Colton suggested. "I think Sophrenia's spell is starting to wear off. My horse is staggering, and I'm not in much better shape."
"You won't sleep alone in a Pelosian inn," Tinian warned. "Their beds are usually occupied by all sorts of unpleasant little creatures."
"Fleas?" Colton asked.
"And lice and bedbugs the size of mice."
"I guess we'll have to risk it," Sparhawk decided. "The horses won't be able to go much farther, and I don't think the Seeker would attack us inside a building. It seems to prefer open country."
He led the way down the hill to the village. The streets of the town were unpaved, and they were ankle-deep in mud. They reached the town's only inn, and Sparhawk carried Sophrenia to the porch, while Curick followed with Flute. The steps leading up to the door were caked with mud, and the boot scraper beside the door showed little signs of use. Pelosians, it appeared, were indifferent to mud. The interior of the inn was dim and smoky, and it smelled strongly of stale sweat and spoiled food. The floor had at one time been covered with rushes, but except in the corners, the rushes were buried in dried mud.
"Are you sure you don't want to reconsider this?" Tinian asked Colton as they entered.
"My stomach's fairly strong," Colton replied, "and I caught a whiff of beer when we came in." The supper the innkeeper provided was at least marginally edible, although a bit over-garnished with boiled cabbage, and the beds, mere straw pallets, were not nearly so bug-infested as Tinian had predicted. They rose early the next morning, and rode out of the muddy village in a murky dawn.
"Doesn't the sun ever shine in this part of the world?" Talon asked sourly.
"It's spring," Curick told him. "It's always cloudy and rainy in the spring. It's good for the crops."
"I'm not a radish, Curick," the boy replied. "I don't need to be watered."
"Talk to God about it." Curick shrugged. "I don't make the weather."
"God and I aren't on the best of terms," Talon said glibly. "He's busy, and so am I. We try not to interfere with each other."
"The boy is pert," Xavier observed disapprovingly. "Young man," he said, "it is not proper to speak so of the Lord of the Universe."
"You are an honored knight of the church, Sir Xavier," Talon pointed out. "I am but a thief of the street. Different rules apply to us. God's great flower garden needs a few weeds to offset the splendor of the roses. I'm a weed. I'm sure God forgives me for that, since I'm a part of his grand design."
Xavier looked at him helplessly, and then began to laugh. They rode warily across southeastern Pelosia for the next several days, taking turns scouting on ahead, and riding to hilltops to survey the surrounding countryside. The sky remained dreary as they pushed on to the east. They saw peasants, serfs actually, laboring in the fields with the crudest of implements. There were birds nesting in the hedges, and occasionally they saw deer grazing among herds of scrubby cattle. While there were people about, Sparhawk and his friends saw no more church soldiers or Zamoks. They remained cautious, however, avoiding people when possible, and continuing their scouting, since they all knew the black-robed Seeker could enlist even normally timid serfs to do its bidding. As they came closer to the border of Lamarkand, they received increasingly disturbing reports concerning turmoil in that kingdom. Lamarks were not the most stable people in the world. The king of Lamarkand ruled only at the sufferance of the largely independent barons, who retreated in times of trouble to positions behind the walls of massive castles. Blood feuds dating back 100 years or more were common, and rogue barons looted and pillaged at will. For the most part, Lamarkand existed in a state of perpetual civil war. They made camp one night, perhaps 3 leagues from the border of that most troubled of western kingdoms, and Sparhawk stood up directly after a supper of the last of Colton's hindquarter of beef.
"All right," he said. "What are we walking into? What's stirring things up in Lamarkand? Any ideas?"
"I spent the last 8 or 9 years in Lamarkand," Colton said seriously. "They're strange people. A Lamark will sacrifice anything he owns for the sake of revenge, and the women are even worse than the men. A good Lamark girl will spend her whole life and all her father's wealth for the chance to sink a spear into somebody who refused her invitation to the dance at some midwinter party.
I spent all those years there, and in all that time I never heard anyone laugh or saw anyone smile. It's the bleakest place on earth. The sun is forbidden to shine in Lammerkand.
Is this universal warfare we've been hearing about from the Pelosians a common thing? Sparhawk asked.
Pelosians are not the best judges of Lammerk peculiarities, Tinian replied thoughtfully. It's only the influence of the Church and the presence of the Church Knights that's kept Pelosia and Lammerkand from blithely embarking on a war of mutual extinction. They despise each other with a passion that's almost holy in its mindless ferocity.
Sophrenia sighed.
Eline's, she said.
We have our fault, little mother, Sparhawk conceded. We're going to run into trouble when we cross the border, then, aren't we?
Not entirely, Tinian said, rubbing his chin. Are you open to another suggestion, maybe?
I'm always open to suggestions.
Why don't we put on our formal armor? Not even the most wild-eyed Lammerk baron will willingly cross the church, and the church knights could grind Western Lammerkand into powder if they felt like it.
What if somebody calls our bluff? Carlton asked. There are only 5 of us, after all.
I don't think they'd have any reason to, Tinian said. The neutrality of the church knights in these local disputes is legendary. Formal armor might be just the thing to avoid misunderstandings. Our purpose is to get to Lake Rondera, not to engage in random disputes with hotheads.
It might work, Sparhawk, Euloth said. It's worth a try, anyway.
All right, let's do it, then, Sparhawk decided. When they arose the following morning, the 5 knights unpacked their formal armor and began to put it on with the help of Curic and Beirut. Sparhawk and Carlton wore pandion black, with silver surcoats and formal black capes. Bavier's armor was burnished to a silvery sheen, and his surcoat and cape were pristine white. Tinian's armor was simply massive steel, but his surcoat and cape were a brilliant sky blue. Euloth put aside the utilitarian mail shirt he had worn on the trail, and replaced it with chainmail trousers and a mail coat that reached to mid-thigh. He stowed away his simple conical helmet and green traveler's cloak, and put on instead a green surcoat and a very impressive-looking helmet surmounted by a pair of the curled and twisted horns he had identified as having come from an ogre.
Well, Sparhawk said to Sophrenia when they had finished putting on their finery, how do we look?
Very impressive, she complimented them. Talon, however, eyed them critically. They look sort of like an ironworks that sprouted legs, don't they? He observed to Beirut.
Be polite, Beirut said, concealing a smile behind one hand. That's depressing, Carlton said to Sparhawk. Do you think we really look that ridiculous to the common people?
Probably.
Curic and Beirut cut lances from a nearby yew grove and affixed steel points to them.
Pennons? Curic asked.
What do you think? Sparhawk asked Tinian.
It couldn't hurt. Let's try to look as impressive as we can, I suppose. They mounted with some difficulty, adjusted their shields, and moved their pennon-flagged lances into positions where they were prominently displayed, and rode out. Theron immediately began to prance.
Oh, stop that, Sparhawk told him disgustedly.
They crossed into Lammerkand not much past noon. The border guards looked suspicious, but automatically gave way to the knights of the church dressed in their formal armor and wearing expressions of inexorable resolve. The Lammerk city of Caddick stood on the far side of a river. There was a bridge, but Sparhawk decided against going through that bleak, ugly place. Instead, he checked his map and turned north. The river branches upstream, he told the others. We'll be able to ford it up there. We're going more or less in that direction anyway, and towns are filled with people who just might want to talk to alien strangers asking questions about us. They rode on north to the series of small streams that fed into the main channel. It was when they were crossing one of those shallow streams that afternoon that they saw a large body of Lammerk warriors on the far bank.
Spread out, Sparhawk commanded tersely. Sophrenia, take Talon and Flute to the rear.
You think they might belong to the Seeker? Carlton asked, moving his hand up the shaft of his lance.
We'll find out in a minute. Don't do anything rash, but be ready for trouble.
The leader of the group of warriors was a burly fellow wearing a chain coat, a steel helmet with a protruding pig-faced visor, and stout leather boots.
He advanced into the stream alone and raised his visor to show that he had no hostile intentions.
"I think he's all right, Sparhawk," Xavier said quietly. "He doesn't have that blank look on his face that the men we killed back in Alania had."
"Well met, Sir Knights," the Lamarck said.
Sparhawk nudged Farron forward a bit through the swirling current.
"Well met indeed, my lord," he replied. "This is a fortunate encounter," the Lamarck continued. "It seemed to me that we might have ridden even so far as Alania ere we had encountered Church Knights."
"And what is your business with the Knights of the Church, my lord?" Sparhawk asked politely.
"We require a service of you, Sir Knight, a service that bears directly on the well-being of the Church."
"We live but to serve her," Sparhawk said, struggling to conceal his irritation. "Speak further concerning this necessary service."
"As all the world knows, the Patriarch of Kadok is the paramount choice for the Archprelate's throne in Kyrillos," the helmeted Lamarck stated.
"I hadn't heard that," Colton said quietly from behind.
"Hush,"
Sparhawk muttered over his shoulder.
"Say on, my lord," he said to the Lamarck. "Misfortunately, civil turmoil mars Western Lamarckand presently," the Lamarck continued.
"I like misfortunately," Tinian murmured to Colton. "It's got a nice ring to it."
"Will you two be quiet?" Sparhawk snapped.
Then he looked back at the man in the chain coat.
"Rumor has advised us of this discord, my lord," he replied. "But surely this is a local matter and does not involve the Church." "I will speak to the point, Sir Knight. The Patriarch Ortsel of Kadok has been forced by the turmoil I but recently mentioned to seek shelter in the stronghold of his brother, the Baron Alstrom, whom I have the honor to serve. Rude civil discord rears its head here in Lamarckand, and we anticipate with some certainty that the foes of my lord Alstrom will shortly besiege his fortress."
"We are but five, my lord," Sparhawk pointed out. "Surely our aid would be of little use in a protracted siege."
"Ah, no, Sir Knight," the Lamarck said with a disdainful smile. "We can sustain ourselves and my lord Alstrom's castle without the aid of the invincible knights of the Church. My lord Alstrom's castle is impregnable, and his foes may freely dash themselves to bits against its walls for a generation or more, without causing us alarm. As I have said, however, the Patriarch Ortsel is the paramount choice for the Archprelacy, in the event of the demise of the revered Clavonus, which, please God, may be delayed for a time. Thus I charge you and your noble companion, Sir Knight, to convey his grace safe and whole to the sacred city of Kyrillos, so that he may stand for election should that mournful necessity come to pass. With that end in view, I will forthwith convey you and your knightly companions to the stronghold of my lord of Alstrom, so that you may undertake this noble task. Let us then proceed."
Chapter 4 The castle of Baron Alstrom was situated on a rocky promontory on the east bank of the river. The promontory jutted out into the main channel a few leagues above the town of Kadok. It was a bleak, ugly fortress, squatting toad-like under a cheerless sky. Its walls were thick and high, seeming to reflect the stiff, unyielding arrogance of its owner.
"Impregnable," Xavier murmured derisively to Sparhawk as the knight in the chain coat preceded them along the short causeway that led out to the castle gate. "I could reduce these walls within the space of 2 years. No Arshan noble would feel secure with such flimsy fortifications."
"Arshans have more time to build their castles," Sparhawk pointed out to the white-caped knight. "It takes longer to start a war in Arshan than it does here in Lamarckand. You can start a war here in about 5 minutes, and it's likely to go on for generations."
"Truly," Xavier agreed. He smiled faintly. "In my youth I gave some time to the study of military history. When I turned to the volumes dealing with Lamarckand, I threw up my hands in despair. No rational man could sort out all the alliances, betrayals, and blood feuds that seethe just below the surface of this unhappy kingdom."
The drawbridge boomed down, and they clattered on across it into the castle's main court.
"And it please you, Sir Knights," the Lamarck knight said, dismounting, "I will convey you directly into the presence of the Baron Alstrom and his grace the Patriarch Ortsel. Time is pressing, and we must see his grace safely out of the castle ere the forces of Count Jerek mount their siege."
"Lead on, Sir Knight," Sparhawk said, clanking down from Farron's back.
He leaned his lance against the wall of the stable, hung his silver-embossed black shield on his saddle, and handed his reins to a waiting groom. They went up a broad stone staircase and through the pair of massive doors at its top. The hallway beyond was torchlit, and the stones of its walls were massive.
"Did you warn that groom?" Colton asked, falling in beside Sparhawk, his long black cape swirling about his ankles.
"About what?"
"Your horse's disposition."
"I forgot," Sparhawk confessed. "He'll find out on his own, I imagine."
"He probably already has."
The room to which the Lamarck knight led them was bleak. In many respects, it was more like an armory than living quarters. Swords and axes hung on the walls, and pikes in clusters of a dozen or so leaned in the corners. A fire burned in a huge vaulted fireplace, and the few chairs were heavy and unpadded. There was no carpeting on the floor, and a number of huge wolfhounds dozed here and there. Baron Alstrom was a grim-faced, melancholy-looking man. His black hair and beard were shot with gray. He wore a mail coat and had a broadsword at his waist. His surcoat was black and elaborately embroidered in red, and like the knight in the pig-faced helmet, he wore boots. Their escort bowed stiffly.
"By good fortune, my lord, I encountered these knights of the church no more than a league from your walls. They were gracious enough to accompany me here."
"Did we have any choice?" Colton muttered.
The baron rose from his chair with a movement made clumsy by the encumbrance of armor and sword.
"Greetings, sir knights," he said in a voice without much warmth.
"It was indeed fortuitous that Sir Enmon encountered you so near this stronghold. The forces of mine enemy will presently besiege me here, and my brother must be safely away before they come."
"Yes, my lord," Sparhawk replied, removing his black helmet and looking after the departing Lamarck in the chain coat. "Sir Enmon advised us of the circumstances. Might it not have been more prudent, however, to have sent your brother on his way with an escort of your own troops? It was only a chance meeting that brought us to your gate before your enemies come."
Alstrom shook his head. "The warriors of County Jerick would certainly attack my men on sight. Only under escort of the knights of the church will my brother be safe, Sir
Sparhawk."
Alstrom looked briefly surprised.
"The name is not unknown to us," he said. He looked inquiringly at the others, and Sparhawk made the introductions.
"An oddly assorted party, Sir Sparhawk," Alstrom observed after he had bowed perfunctorily to Sophrenia.
"But is it wise to take the lady and the two children on a journey that might involve danger?"
"The lady is essential to our purpose," Sparhawk replied. "The little girl is under her care, and the boy is her page. She would not leave them behind."
"Page," he heard Talon whisper to Beirut. "I've been called a lot of things, but that's a new one."
"Hush," Beirut whispered back.
"What astonishes me even more, however," Alstrom continued, "is the fact that all four of the militant orders are represented here. Relations between the orders have not been cordial of late, I've been told."
"We are embarked upon a quest which directly involves the church," Sparhawk explained, taking off his gauntlets. "It is of such pressing urgency that our preceptors brought us together that we might by our unity prevail."
"The unity of the church knights, like that of the church herself, is long overdue," a harsh voice said from the far side of the room.
A churchman stepped out of the shadows. His black cassock was plain, even severe, and his hollow-cheeked face was bleakly ascetic. His hair was pale blonde, streaked with gray, and it fell straight to his shoulders, appearing to have been hacked off at that point with the blade of a knife.
"My brother," Alstrom introduced him, "the Patriarch Ortsel of Kadok."
Sparhawk bowed, his armor creaking slightly.
"Your grace," he said.
"This church matter you mentioned interests me," Ortsel said, coming forward into the light. "What can it be that is of such urgency that it impels the preceptors of the four orders to set aside old enmities and to send their champions forth as one?"
Sparhawk thought only a moment, then gambled.
"Is your grace perhaps acquainted with Aeneas, Primate of Cimera?" he asked, depositing his gauntlets in his helmet.
Ortsel's face hardened.
"We've met."
he said flatly. "We've also had that pleasure," Colton said dryly. "Often enough more than to satisfy me, at least." Ortzel smiled briefly. "I gather that our opinions of the good primate more or less coincide," he suggested. "Your grace is perceptive," Sparhawk noted smoothly. "The primate of Cimera aspires to a position in the church for which our preceptors feel he is unqualified." "I have heard of his aspirations in that direction." "This is the main thrust of our quest, Your Grace," Sparhawk explained. "The primate of Cimera is deeply involved in the politics of Elania. The lawful queen of that realm is Alana, daughter to the late King Aldreus. She is, however, gravely ill, and Primate Annius controls the royal council, which means, of course, that he also controls the royal treasury. It is his access to that treasury that fuels his hopes to ascend the throne of the Archprelacy. He has more or less unlimited funds at his disposal, and certain members of the hierocracy have proved to be susceptible to his blandishments. It is our mission to restore the queen to health so that she might once again take the rulership of her kingdom into her own hands." "An unseemly state of affairs," Baron Alstrom observed disapprovingly. "No kingdom should be ruled by a woman." "I have the honor to be the queen's champion, my lord," Sparhawk declared, "and I hope her friend as well. I have known her since she was a child, and I assure you that Alana is no ordinary woman. She has more steel in her than almost any other monarch in all of Eosia. Once she is restored to health, she will be more than a match for the primate of Cimera. She will cut off his access to the treasury as easily as she would snip off a stray lock of hair. And without that money, the primate's hopes die." "Then your quest is a noble one, Sir Sparhawk," Patriarch Ortzel approved. "But why has it brought you to Lamarkand?" "May I speak frankly, Your Grace?" "Of course. We have recently discovered that Queen Alana's illness is not of natural origin, and to cure her we must resort to extreme measures."
"You're speaking too delicately, Sparhawk," Ulith growled, removing his ogre-horned helmet. "What my Pandion brother is trying to say, Your Grace, is that Queen Alana has been poisoned, and that we'll have to use magic to bring her back to health."
"Poisoned?" Ortzel paled. "Surely you do not suspect Primate Annius?"
"Everything points that way, Your Grace," Tinian said, pushing back his blue cape. "The details are tedious, but we have strong evidence that Annius was behind it all."
"You must bring these charges before the Hierocracy," Ortzel exclaimed. "If they are true, this is monstrous."
"The matter is already in the hands of the Patriarch of Deimos, Your Grace," Sparhawk assured him. "I think we can trust him to lay it before the Hierocracy at the proper time."
"Dolmant is a good man," Ortzel agreed. "I'll abide by his decision in the matter, for the time being, at least."
"Please be seated, Sir Knights," the Baron said. "The urgency of this present situation has made me remiss in matters of courtesy. Might I offer you some refreshment?"
Colton's eyes brightened.
"Never mind," Sparhawk muttered to him, holding a chair for Sophrenia. She sat, and Flute came over and climbed up into her lap.
"Your daughter, madame?" Ortzel surmised.
"No, Your Grace. She's a foundling, of sorts. I'm fond of her, however."
"Bayret," Curic said. "We're just in the way here. Let's go to the stables. I want to check over the horses." And the two of them left the room.
"Tell me, my lord," Xavier said to Baron Alstrom, "what is it that has brought you to the brink of war? Some ancient dispute, perhaps?"
"No, Sir Xavier," the Baron replied, his face hardening. "This is an affair of more recent origin. Perhaps a year ago, my only son became friendly with a knight who said he was from Camoria. I have since discovered that the man is a villain. He encouraged my young and foolish son in a vain hope of obtaining the hand of the daughter of my neighbor, Count Jerick. The girl seemed amenable, though her father and I have never been friends. Not long after, however, Jerick announced that he had promised his daughter's hand to another. My son was enraged. His so-called friend goaded him on in this and proposed a desperate plan. They could abduct the girl, find a priest willing to marry her to my son, and present Jerick with a number of grandchildren to still his wrath.
They climbed the walls of the Count's castle and crept into the girl's bedchamber. I have since discovered that my son's supposed friend had alerted the Count, and Jerick and his sister's 7 sons sprang from hiding as the 2 entered. My son, believing that it had been the Count's daughter who had betrayed him, plunged his dagger into her breast before the Count's nephews fell upon him with their swords. Ostrom paused, his teeth clenched and his eyes brimming. My son was obviously in the wrong, he admitted, continuing his story, and I would not have pursued the matter, grieved though I was. It was what happened after my son's death that has set eternal enmity between Jerick and myself. Not content with merely killing my son, the Count and his sister's savage brood mutilated his body and contemptuously deposited it at my castle gate. I was outraged, but the Camorrian knight, whom I still trusted, advised guile. He pled matters of pressing urgency in Camorria, but promised me the aid of 2 of his trusted retainers. It was but last week when the 2 arrived at my door to tell me that the time for my revenge had come. They led my soldiers to the house of the Count's sister, and there they slaughtered the Count's 7 nephews. I have since discovered that these 2 underlings inflamed my soldiers, and they took certain liberties with the person of Jerick's sister.
That's a delicate way to put it, Carlton whispered to Sparhawk.
Be still, Sparhawk whispered back.
The lady was dispatched, naked, I'm afraid, to her brother's castle. Reconciliation is now quite impossible. Jerick has many allies, as do I, and Western Lamarkand now hovers on the brink of general war.
A melancholy tale, my lord, Sparhawk said sadly.
The impending war is my concern. What is important now is to remove my brother from this house and to convey him safely to Kyrolos. Should he also fall during Jerick's attack, the church will have no choice but to send in her knights. The murder of a patriarch, particularly one who is a strong candidate for elevation to the archprelacy, would be a crime she could not ignore. Thus it is that I implore you to safeguard him on his way to the Holy City.
One question, my lord, Sparhawk said. The activities of this Camorrian knight have a familiar ring to them. Can you describe him and his underlings to us?
The knight himself is a tall man, with an arrogant bearing. One of his companions is a huge brute, scarcely human. The other is a rabbity fellow with an excessive fondness for strong drink.
Sounds a bit like some old friends, doesn't it? Carlton said to Sparhawk.
Was there anything unusual about this knight?
His hair was absolutely white, Ostrom replied, and he was not that old.
Martell certainly moves around, doesn't he? Carlton observed. You know this man, Sir Carlton? The Baron asked.
The white-haired man is named Martell, Sparhawk exclaimed. His 2 hirelings are Addis and Krager. Martell's a renegade Pandion knight who hires out his services in various parts of the world. Most recently, he's been working for the Primate of Cimera.
But what would be the Primate's purpose in fomenting discord between Jerick and me?
You've already touched on that, my lord, Sparhawk replied. The preceptors of the 4 militant orders are firmly opposed to the notion of Aeneas sitting on the Archprelate's throne. They will be present and voting during the election in the Basilica of Kyrolos, and their opinion carries great weight with the hierocracy. Moreover, the knights of the church would respond immediately to the first hint of any irregularities in the election. If Aeneas is to succeed, he must get the church knights out of Kyrolos before the election. We were recently able to thwart a plot that Martell was hatching in Rendor that would have pulled the knights out of the holy city. It's my guess that this unhappy affair you told us about is yet another. Martell, acting on orders from Aeneas, is roaming the world building bonfires in the hope that sooner or later the knights of the church will be forced to move out of Kyrolos to extinguish them.
Is Aeneas truly so depraved? Ortsel asked.
Your Grace, Aeneas will do anything to ascend that throne. I'm positive that he'd order the massacre of half of Eosia to get what he wants.
How is it possible for a churchman to stoop so low?
Ambition, Your Grace, Xavier said sadly. Once it sinks its claws into a man's heart, the man becomes blind to all else.
This is all the more reason to get my brother safely to Kyrolos,
Ostrom said gravely. He is much respected by the other members of the hierocracy, and his voice will carry great weight in their deliberations.
I must advise you and your brother, my Lord Ostrom, that there is a certain risk involved in your plan, Sparhawk warned them. We are being pursued. There are those bent on thwarting us in our quest. Since your brother's safety is your first concern, I should tell you that I cannot guarantee it. The ones who are pursuing us are determined and very dangerous.
He spoke obliquely, since neither Ostrom nor Ortsel would give him much credence if he told them the bald truth about the nature of the Seeker.
I'm afraid I have no real choice in the matter, says Sparhawk. With this anticipated siege hanging over my head, I have to get my brother out of the castle, no matter what the risk.
As long as you understand, my lord. Sparhawk sighed. Our mission is of the gravest urgency. But this matter overshadows even that.
Sparhawk!
Sophronia gasped.
We have no choice, little mother, he told her. We absolutely must get his grace safely out of Lamarkand and to Kyrelos. The Baron is right. If anything happens to his brother, the church knights will ride out of Kyrelos to retaliate. Nothing could prevent it. We'll have to take his grace to the holy city and then try to make up for lost time.
What precisely is the object of your search, Sir Sparhawk? The Patriarch of Kadok asked.
As Sir Euleth explained, we are forced to resort to magic to restore the Queen of Elenia to health. And there's only one thing in the world with that much power. We're on our way to the great battlefield at Lake Rondera to seek out the jewel which once surmounted the royal crown of Thalesia.
The Belium? Ortsel was shocked. Surely you would not bring that accursed thing to light again.
We have no choice, your grace. Only Belium can restore my queen.
But Belium is tainted. All the wickedness of the troll gods infects it.
The troll gods aren't all that bad, your grace, Euleth said. They're capricious, I'll grant you, but they're not truly evil.
The Aline god forbids consorting with them.
The Aline god is wise, your grace, Sophronia told him. He has also forbidden contact with the gods of Styricum. He made an exception to his prohibition, however, when the time came to form the militant orders. The younger gods of Styricum agreed to assist him in his design. One wonders if he might not also be able to enlist the aid of the troll gods. He is, I understand, most persuasive.
Blasphemy! Ortsel gasped.
No, your grace, not really. I am Styric, and therefore not subject to Aline theology.
Hadn't we better get going? Euleth suggested. It's a long ride to Kyrelos, and we need to get his grace out of this castle before the fighting starts.
Well put, my laconic friend, Tinian approved.
I shall make ready at once, Ortsel said, going to the door. We will be able to depart within the hour.
And he went out. How long do you think it's likely to be before the Count's forces reach here, my lord? Tinian asked the Baron.
No more than a day, Sir Tinian. I have friends who are impeding his march northward from his keep, but he has a sizable army, and I'm certain he will soon break his way through.
Talon, Sparhawk said sharply, put it back. The boy made a wry face and laid a small dagger with a jeweled hilt back on the table from which he had taken it.
I didn't think you were watching, he said.
Don't ever make that mistake, Sparhawk said. I always watch you. The Baron looked puzzled.
The boy has not yet learned to grasp some of the finer points of property ownership, my lord, Colton said lightly. We've been trying to teach him, but he's a slow learner.
Talon sighed and took up his sketchpad and pencil. Then he sat at a table on the far side of the room and began to draw. He was, Sparhawk remembered, very talented.
I am most grateful to you all, gentlemen, the Baron was saying. The safety of my brother has been my only concern. Now I shall be able to concentrate on the business at hand.
He looked at Sparhawk. Do you think you might possibly encounter this Martell person during the course of your quest?
I most certainly hope so, Sparhawk said fervently.
And is it your intention to kill him?
That's been Sparhawk's intention for the last 12 years or so, Colton said. Martell sleeps very lightly when Sparhawk's in the same kingdom with him.
May God aid your arm, then, Sir Sparhawk, the Baron said. My son will rest more peacefully once his betrayer joins him in the House of the Dead.
The door burst open, and Sir Enmon hurried into the room. "My lord," he said to Ostrom in urgent tones, "come quickly." Ostrom came to his feet. "What is it, Sir Enmon?" "Count Jerrick has deceived us. He has a fleet of ships on the river, and even now his forces are landing on both sides of this promontory." "Sound the alarm," the Baron commanded, "and raise the drawbridge." "At once, my lord." Enmon hurried from the room. Ostrom sighed bleakly. "I'm afraid it's too late, Sir Sparhawk," he said. "Both your quest and the task I set you are doomed now. We are under siege, and we will all be trapped within these walls for a number of years, I fear." Chapter 5. The booming crash of boulders slamming against the walls of Ostrom's castle came with monotonous regularity as the siege engines of Count Jerrick moved into place and began pounding the fortress. Sparhawk and the others had remained in the cheerless, weapons-cluttered room at Ostrom's request, and they sat awaiting his return. "I've never been under siege before," Talon said, looking up from his drawings. "How long do they usually last?"
"If we can't come up with a way to get out of here, you'll be shaving by the time it's over," Kurek told him.
"Do something, Sparhawk," the boy said urgently.
"I'm open to suggestions."
Talon looked at him helplessly. Baron Ostrom came back into the room. His face was bleak.
"I'm afraid we're completely encircled," he said.
"A truce, perhaps," Xavier suggested. "It's customary in Arsham to grant safe passage to women and churchmen before pressing a siege."
"Unfortunately, Sir Xavier," Ostrom replied, "this is not Arsham. This is Lamarkand, and there's no such thing as a truce here."
"Any ideas?" Sparhawk asked Sophrenia.
"A few, perhaps," she said. "Let me have a try at your excellent Aline logic. First, the use of main force to break out of the castle is quite out of the question, wouldn't you say?"
"Absolutely."
"And as you pointed out, a truce would probably not be honored."
"I certainly wouldn't want to gamble His Grace's life or yours on a truce."
"Then there's the possibility of stealth. I don't think that would work either, do you?"
"Too risky," Colton agreed. "The castle is surrounded, and the soldiers will be on the alert for people trying to sneak out."
"Subterfuge of some kind?" she asked.
"Not under these circumstances," Ulith said. "The troops surrounding the castle are armed with crossbows. We'd never get close enough to tell them stories."
"That leaves only the arts of Styricum, doesn't it?"
Ortsel's face stiffened. "I will not be a party to the use of heat and sorcery," he declared. "I was afraid he might look at it that way," Colton murmured to Sparhawk. "I'll try to reason with him in the morning," Sparhawk replied under his breath. He looked at Baron Ostrom. "It's late, my lord," he said, "and we're all tired. Some sleep might clear our heads and hint at other solutions." "Well said, Sir Sparhawk," Ostrom agreed. "My servants will convey you and your companions to safe quarters, and we shall consider this matter further on the morrow."
They were led through the bleak halls of Ostrom's castle to a wing that, while comfortable, showed little signs of use. Supper was brought to them in their rooms, and Sparhawk and Colton removed their armor. After they had eaten, they sat talking quietly in the chamber they shared.
"I could have told you that Ortsel would feel the way he does about magic. The churchmen here in Lamarkand feel almost as strongly about it as Rendor's." "If it had been Dolmant, we might have talked our way around him," Sparhawk agreed glumly.
"Dolmant's more cosmopolitan," Colton said. "He grew up next door to the Pandion Mother House, and he knows a great deal more about the secrets than he lets on."
There was a light rap on the door. Sparhawk rose and answered it. It was Talon. "Sophrenia wants to see you," he told the big knight.
"All right. Go to bed, Colton. You're still looking a bit worse for wear. Lead the way, Talon."
The boy took Sparhawk to the end of the corridor and tapped on the door. "Come in, Talon," Sophrenia replied. "How did you know it was me?" Talon asked curiously as he opened the door. "There are ways," she said mysteriously. The small Styric woman was gently brushing Flute's long black hair. The child had a dreamy look on her small face, and she was humming to herself contentedly. Sparhawk was startled. It was the first vocal sound he had ever heard her utter.
If she can hum, why is it she can't talk? He asked.
Whatever gave you the idea she can't talk?
Sophronia continued her brushing.
She never has done so.
What does that have to do with it?
What did you want to see me about?
It's going to take something rather spectacular to get us out of here, she replied, and I may need your help and that of the others to manage it.
All you have to do is ask. Have you got any ideas at all?
A few. Our first problem is Ortsel, though. If he bows his neck on this, we'll never get him out of the castle.
Suppose I just hit him on the head before we leave, and tie him across his saddle until we're safely away.
Sparhawk,
she chided him.
It was a thought. He shrugged.
What about Flute here?
What about her?
She made those soldiers on the docks at Vardanias and the spies outside the chapter house ignore us. Couldn't she do that here, too?
Do you realize how large that army outside the gate is, Sparhawk? She's just a little girl, after all.
Oh. I didn't know that would make a difference.
Of course it does.
Couldn't you put Ortsel to sleep? Talon asked her. You know, sort of wiggle your fingers at him until he drops off.
It's possible, I suppose. Then he won't know you used magic to get us out of here until he wakes up.
Interesting notion, she conceded.
How did you come up with it?
I'm a thief, Sophronia, he grinned impudently. I wouldn't be very good at it if I couldn't think faster than the other fellow.
However we manage Ortsel is beside the point, Sparhawk said. Our main concern is getting Alstrom's cooperation. He might be a little reluctant to risk his brother's life on something he doesn't understand. I'll talk with him in the morning.
Be very persuasive, Sparhawk, Sophronia said.
I'll try. Come along, Talon. Let the ladies get some sleep. Colton and I have a spare bed in our room. You can sleep there. Sophronia, don't be afraid to call on me and the others if you need help with any spells.
I'm never afraid, Sparhawk. Not when I have you to protect me.
Stop that, he told her. Then he smiled. Sleep well, Sophronia.
You too, dear one.
Good night, Flute, he added. She blew him a little trill on her pipes.
The following morning, Sparhawk rose early and went back into the main part of the castle. As chance had it, he encountered Sir Enmon in the long, torchlit corridor.
How do things stand? He asked the Lamarck Knight.
Enmon's face was gray with fatigue. He had obviously been up all night.
We've had some success, Sir Sparhawk, he replied. We repelled a fairly serious assault on the castle's main gate about midnight, and we're moving our own engines into place. We should be able to begin destroying Jerek's siege machines and his ships before noon.
Will he pull back at that point?
Enmon shook his head.
More likely, he'll begin digging earthwork fortifications. It's probable that the siege will be protracted.
Sparhawk nodded.
I thought that might be the case, he agreed.
Have you any idea where I might find Baron Alstrom? I need to talk with him, out of the hearing of his brother.
Milord Alstrom is atop the battlements at the front of the castle, Sir Sparhawk. He wants Jerek to be able to see him, counter to some rash move. He's alone there. His brother is customarily in chapel at this hour.
Good. I'll go talk with the Baron, then.
It was windy atop the battlements.
Sparhawk had drawn his cloak about his armor to conceal it, and the wind whipped it around his legs.
Ah, good morning, Sir Sparhawk, Baron Alstrom said.
His voice was weary. He wore a full suit of armor, and the visor of his helmet had that peculiar pointed construction common in Lamarkand.
Good morning, my lord, Sparhawk replied, staying back from the battlements.
Back out of sight where we can talk. I'm not sure it's a good idea to let Jerek Knights inside your walls just yet, and I'm sure he has a number of sharp-eyed men watching you.
The tower there above the gate, Alstrom suggested.
Come along, Sir Sparhawk.
He led the way along the parapet. The room inside the tower was grimly functional. A dozen crossbowmen stood at the narrow embrasures along its front, unloosing their bolts at the troops below.
You men, Alstrom commanded, I have need of this room. Go shoot from the battlements for a while.
The soldiers filed out, their metal-shod feet clinking on the stone floor.
We have a problem, my lord,
Sparhawk said when the two of them were alone.
I noticed that, said dryly, glancing out one of the embrasures at the troops massed before his walls.
Sparhawk grinned at this rare flash of humor in a usually dour face.
That particular problem is yours, my lord, he said. Our mutual one is what we're going to do about your brother. Sophronia got directly to the point last night. No purely natural effort is going to affect his escape from the siege. We have no choice. We have to use magic, and his grace appears to be unalterably opposed.
I would not presume to instruct Ortsel in theology, Ostrom said.
Nor would I, my lord.
Might I point out, however, that should his grace ascend to the archprelacy, he's going to have to modify his position, or at least learn to look the other way when this sort of thing happens. The four orders are the military arm of the church, and we routinely utilize the secrets of Styricum in completing our tasks.
I'm aware of that, says Sparhawk. My brother, however, is a rigid man and unlikely to change his views.
Sparhawk began to pace up and down, thinking fast.
Very well, then, he said carefully. What we'll have to do to get your brother out of the castle will seem unnatural to you, but I assure you that it will be very effective. Sophronia is highly skilled in the secrets. I've seen her do things that verge on the miraculous. You have my guarantee that she will in no way endanger your brother.
I understand, says Sparhawk.
Good. I was afraid that you might object.
Most people are reluctant to rely on things they don't understand.
Now then, his grace will in no way participate in what we may have to do. To put it bluntly, he'd just be in the way. All he's going to do is take advantage of it. He will in no way be personally involved in what he considers a sin.
Understand me, says Sparhawk, I am not opposed to you in this. I will try to reason with my brother. Sometimes he listens to me.
Let's hope this is one of those times.
Sparhawk glanced out the window and swore.
What is it, says Sparhawk?
Is that Jerick standing on top of that knoll at the rear of his troops?
The Baron looked out the embrasure.
It is?
You might recognize the man standing beside him.
That's Addus, Martell's underling.
It seems that Martell's been playing both sides in this affair. The one that concerns me, though, is that figure standing off to one side, the tall one in the black robe.
I don't think it poses much of a threat, says Barhawk. It seems to be hardly more than a skeleton.
You notice how its face seems to glow?
Now that you mention it, yes, I do.
Isn't that odd?
It's more than odd, Baron Ulstrom. I think I'd better go talk with Sophronia. She needs to know about this immediately.
Sophronia sat beside the fire in her room with her ever-present teacup in her hands. Flute sat cross-legged on the bed, weaving a cat's cradle of such complexity that Sparhawk pulled his eyes away from it, lest his entire mind become lost in trying to trace out the individual strands.
"We've got trouble," he told his tutor.
"I noticed that," she replied. "It's a little more serious than we'd thought. Addus is out there with Count Jerick, and Kroger's probably lurking around somewhere in the background."
"Martell's beginning to make me very tired."
"Addus and Kroger don't add much to the problems we've already got. But that thing, the Seeker, is out there, too."
"Are you sure?"
She came quickly to her feet.
"It's the right size and shape, and that same glow is coming out from under its hood.
How many humans can it take over at any one time?"
"I don't think there are any limits, Sparhawk. Not when Azash is controlling it.
Do you remember those ambushers back near the Pelosian border? How they just kept coming even though we were cutting them to pieces?"
"Yes."
"If the Seeker can gain control of Jerick's whole army, they'll mount an assault that Baron Alstrom's forces won't be able to withstand. We'd better get out of here in a hurry, Sophronia. Have you come up with anything yet?"
"There are a few possibilities," she replied. "The presence of the Seeker complicates things a bit, but I think I know a way to get around it."
"I hope so. Let's go talk with the others." It was perhaps a half hour later when they all gathered again in the room where they had first met the previous day.
"Very well, gentlemen," Sophronia said to them. "We are in great danger."
"The castle is quite secure, madame," Ostrom assured her. "In 500 years it has never once fallen to besiegers."
I'm afraid things are different this time. A besieging army usually assaults the walls, doesn't it?
It's the common practice once the siege engines have weakened the fortifications.
After the assaulting force has taken heavy casualties, they normally fall back, don't they?
That's been my experience.
Jerek's men will not fall back. They will continue their attack until they overwhelm the castle.
How can you be so sure? You remember the figure in the black robe I pointed out to you, my lord?
Sparhawk said.
Yes. It seemed to cause you some concern.
With good reason, my lord.
That's the creature that's been pursuing us. It's called a Seeker. It's not human, and it's subject to Azash.
Beware of what you say, Sir Sparhawk,
Patriarch Ortsel said ominously.
The Church does not recognize the existence of the Styric gods. You are treading very close to the brink of heresy.
Just for the purposes of this discussion, let's assume that I know what I'm talking about, Sparhawk replied. Putting Azash aside for the moment, it's important for you and your brother to understand just how dangerous that thing out there really is. It will be able to control Jerek's troops completely, and it will hurl them against this castle until they succeed in taking it. Not only that, Xavier added bleakly, they will pay no attention to wounds that would incapacitate a normal man. The only way to stop them is to kill them. We've met men under the Seeker's control before, and we had to kill every last one of them.
Sir Sparhawk, Alstrom said. Count Jerek is my mortal enemy, but he's still an honorable man and a faithful son of the Church. He would not consort with a creature of darkness.
It's entirely possible that the Count doesn't even know it's there, Sophrenia said. The whole point here, however, is that we're all in deadly peril.
Why would that creature join forces with Jerek? Alstrom asked.
As Sparhawk said, it's been pursuing us. For some reason, Azash looks upon Sparhawk as a threat. The Elder Gods have some ability to see into the future, and it's possible that Azash has caught a glimpse of something he wants to prevent. He's already made several attempts on Sparhawk's life. It's my belief that the Seeker is here for the express purpose of killing Sparhawk, or at the very least, preventing his recovering Belium. We must leave, my lord, and quickly. She turned to Ortsel. I'm afraid, Your Grace, that we have no choice. We are compelled to resort to the arts of Styricum.
I will not be a party to that, he said stiffly. I know that you are Styric, madame, and therefore ignorant of the dictates of the true faith. But how dare you propose to practice your black arts in my presence? I am a churchman, after all.
I think that in time you may be obliged to modify your views, Your Grace, Euleth said calmly. The militant orders are the arms of the Church. We receive instruction in the secret so that we may better serve her. This practice has been approved by every archprelate for 900 years.
Indeed, Sophrenia added. No Styric will consent to teach the knights until approval is given by each new archprelate.
Should it come to pass that I ascend the throne in Kyrellos, that practice shall cease.
Then the West will surely be doomed, she predicted. For without these arts, the Church knights will be helpless against Azash. And without the knights, the West will fall before the hordes of Otha.
We have no evidence that Otha is coming.
We have no evidence that summer is coming either, she said dryly.
She looked at Alstrom.
I believe I have a plan that may affect our escape, my lord. But first I'll need to go to your kitchen and talk with your cook. He looked puzzled. The plan involves certain ingredients normally found in kitchens. I need to be certain they're available.
There's a guard at the door, madame, he said. He will escort you to the kitchen.
Thank you, my lord. Come along, Flute.
And she went out.
What's she up to? Tinian asked.
Sophrenia almost never explains things in advance, Colton told him.
Or afterward either, I've noticed,
Talon added, looking up from his drawing.
Speak when you're spoken to, Barrett told him. If I did that, I'd forget how to talk.
Surely you're not going to permit this, Alstrom,
Ortsel said angrily.
I don't have much choice, Alstrom replied. We absolutely must get you to safety, and this seems to be the only way.
Did you see Kroger out there, too?
Colton asked Sparhawk.
No, but I imagine he's around somewhere. Somebody's got to keep an eye on Ardus.
Is this Ardus so very dangerous? Alstrom asked.
He's an animal, my lord, Colton replied.
and a very stupid one. Sparhawk's promised that I get to kill Addis if I don't interfere when he goes after Martell. Addis can barely talk, and he kills for the sheer pleasure of it.
He's dirty and he smells bad, too, Talon added. He chased me down a street once in Camoria, and the odor almost knocked me off my feet.
You think Martell might be with them? Tinian asked hopefully.
I doubt it, Sparhawk said. I think I nailed his foot to the floor down in Rendor. It's my guess that he set things up here in Lemurkand, and then went to Rendor to hatch things there. Then he sent Kroger and Addis back here to set things in motion.
I think the world would be better off without this Martell of yours, Ostrom said.
We're going to do what we can to arrange that, my lord, Ulith rumbled.
A few moments later, Sophrenia and Flute returned.
Did you find the things you need? Sparhawk asked.
Most of them, she replied. I can make the others.
She looked at Ortsel.
You might wish to retire, Your Grace, she suggested. I don't want to offend your sensibilities.
I will remain, madame, he said coldly. Perhaps my presence will prevent this abomination from coming to pass.
Perhaps, but I rather doubt it. She pursed her lips and looked critically at the small earthen jar she had carried from the kitchen. Sparhawk, she said, I'm going to need an empty barrel.
He went to the door and spoke with the guard.
Sophrenia walked to the table and picked up a crystal goblet. She spoke at some length in Styric, and with a soft rustling sound, the goblet was suddenly filled with a powder that looked much like lavender sand.
Outrageous, Ortsel muttered.
Sophrenia ignored him. Tell me, my lord, she said to Ostrom. You have pitch and naphtha, I assume.
Of course. They're a part of the castle's defenses.
Good. If this is to work, we're going to need them.
The soldier entered, rolling a barrel.
Right here, please, she instructed, pointing to a spot away from the fire.
He set the barrel upright, saluted the baron, and left.
Sophrenia spoke briefly to Flute. The little girl nodded and lifted her pipes. Her melody was strange, hypnotic, and almost languorous.
The Styric woman stood over the barrel, speaking in Styric and holding the jar in one hand and the goblet in the other. Then she began to pour their contents into the barrel. The pungent spices in the jar and the lavender sand in the goblet came spilling out, but neither vessel emptied. The two streams, mixing as they fell, began to glow, and the room was suddenly filled with star-like glitterings that soared firefly-like and sparkled on the walls and ceiling. Sophrenia poured on and on. Minute after minute, the small woman continued to pour from the two seemingly inexhaustible containers. It took nearly half an hour to fill the barrel.
There, Sophrenia said at last. That should be enough.
She looked down into the glowing barrel. Ortsel was making strangling sounds. She put the two containers far apart on the table.
I wouldn't let these two get mixed together, my lord, she cautioned Ostrom, and keep them away from any kind of fire.
What are we doing here? Tinian asked her.
We must drive the seeker away, Tinian. We'll mix what's in this barrel with naphtha and pitch, and load the baron's siege engines with the mixture. Then we'll ignite it, and throw it in among Count Jerek's troops. The fumes will force them to withdraw, temporarily at least. That's not the main reason we're doing it, however. The Seeker has a much different breathing apparatus than humans do. The fumes are noxious to humans. To the Seeker, they're lethal. It will either flee or die.
That sounds encouraging, he said.
Was it really all so very terrible, Your Grace? She asked Ortsel. It's going to save your life, you know. His face was troubled.
I had always thought that Styric sorcery was mere trickery. But there was no way you could have done what I just saw by charlatanism. I will pray on this matter. I will seek guidance from God.
I wouldn't take too long, Your Grace, Colton advised. If you do, it could be that you'll arrive in Kyrelos just in time to kiss the ring of the archprelate Aeneas.
That must never happen, Ostrom declared sternly. The siege at the gates is my concern, Ortsel, not yours. Therefore I must regretfully withdraw my hospitality. You will leave my castle just as soon as it's convenient.
Ostrom, Ortsel gasped. This is my home. I was born here.
But our father left it to me. Your proper home is in the Basilica of Kyrelos.
I advise you to go there at once.
Chapter 6
We'll need to go to the highest point in your castle, my lord, Sophronia said after the Patriarch of Kazakh had angrily stormed from the room.
That would be the North Tower, he replied.
And can one see the besieging army from there?
Yes.
Good. First, however, we must give your soldiers instructions on how to proceed with this.
She pointed at the barrel.
All right, gentlemen, she said crisply, don't just stand there. Pick the barrel up and bring it along. And whatever you do, don't drop it or get it near any fire.
Her instructions to the soldiers manning the catapults were fairly simple, explaining the proper mixture of the powder, naphtha, and pitch.
Now, she went on, listen very carefully. Your own safety depends on this. Do not set fire to the naphtha until the last possible instant. And if any of the smoke blows in your direction, hold your breath and run. Under no circumstances breathe any of those fumes.
Will they kill us? One soldier asked in a frightened voice.
No, but they'll make you ill and confuse your minds. Cover your noses and mouths with damp cloths. That may protect you a bit. Wait for the Baron's signal from the North Tower.
She tested the wind direction.
Hurl the burning material to the north of those troops on the causeway, she told them, and don't forget to throw some at those ships in the river as well.
Very well, then, Baron Alstrom. Let's go to the tower. As it had been for the last several days, the sky was cloudy, and a brisk wind whistled through the unpainted embrasures of the North Tower. Like all such purely defensive constructions, the tower was severely utilitarian. The besieging army of Count Jerek looked oddly ant-like, a mass of tiny men with armor glinting the color of pewter in the pale light. Despite the height of the tower, an occasional crossbow bolt chinked against its weathered stones.
Be careful, Sparhawk murmured to Sophronia as she thrust her head out one of the embrasures to peer at the troops massed before the gate.
There's no danger, she assured him as the wind whipped at her hooded white robe. My goddess protects me.
You can believe in your goddess all you want, he replied, but your safety is my responsibility. Have you any idea of what Vanion would do to me if I let you get hurt?
And that's only after I got through with him, Colton growled.
She stepped back from the embrasure and stood tapping one finger thoughtfully against her pursed lips.
Forgive me, madame, Alstrom said. I recognize the necessity of chasing off that creature out there. But a purely temporary withdrawal of Jerek's troops won't really do us all that much good. They'll return as soon as the smoke dissipates, and we still won't be any closer to getting my brother safely away from here.
If we do this right, they won't return for several days, my lord.
Are the fumes that powerful?
No, they'll clear off in an hour or so.
That's hardly time enough for you to make good your escape, he pointed out.
What's to prevent Jerek from coming back and continuing the siege?
He's going to be very busy.
Busy?
With what?
He's going to be chasing some people.
And who is that?
You, me, Sparhawk, and the others, your brother, and a fair number of men from your garrison.
I don't think that's wise, madame, Alstrom said critically. We have secure fortifications here. I don't propose to abandon them and risk all our lives in flight.
We're not going anywhere just yet.
But you just said,
Jerek and his men will think they're pursuing us. What they'll actually be chasing, however, will be an illusion. She smiled briefly. Some of the best magic is illusion, she said. You trick the mind and the eye into believing wholly in something that's not really there. Jerek will be absolutely convinced that we're trying to take advantage of the confusion to bolt. He'll follow with his army. And that should give us plenty of time to slip your brother away to safety. Is that forest on the horizon fairly extensive?
It goes on for several leagues.
Very good. We'll lead Jerek in there with our illusion, and let him wander around among the trees for the next few days.
End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.